Joey Block. Well, it was a week of history in the making. Three big stories that we are following that could potentially be something we look back on hundreds of years from now. An impeachment vote failed of a cabinet member, something we haven't seen in over 100 years. We'll be talking about that. Also, a classified document scandal. Is it over? Well, the special counsel in the Biden classified documents case, he says, well, there's no charges going to be recommended, but there is something more to be told here. We'll be talking about that as well. Also, we can't forget that historic Supreme Court hearing, a landmark case that's being heard right now on the 14th Amendment, that could change elections potentially for the future in this country. So a lot to get to here today. This week certainly was not one shy of news. Probably you were trying to keep it all together. We're going to talk about the top three here. And of course, in the state news right now, we have all these state conventions that are going on. There's the Democratic side, that's ramping up. But then on the Republican side, in Union County and Hunterdon County, they're weighing in on who they want to be our next senator. A lot to talk about there. But let's get into the breaking news of the beginning of the week. We'll start at the beginning. Why not, shall we? Because we have to continue on here and try to connect all this together. Well, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas has narrowly survived a vote to impeach him. The vote came down 214 in favor and 216 against, with four Republicans opposing it. Now, it's important to note here that House Majority Leader Steve Scalise was out of town receiving cancer treatment when this all went down, but his office says he's coming back next week, so we may see another vote there. And why, you may ask? Well, the next part will explain this. Four Republicans voted against this impeachment, and they were Colorado Congressman Ken Buck, Wisconsin's Mike Gallagher, and California's Tom McClintock. And there was a fourth guy who, ironically, was the GOP conference vice chair, Blake Moore, who switched his vote at the last minute to allow the House to reconsider the impeachment at another point. So essentially, if they didn't have the certain amount of rejections, then this whole thing would have been tabled and the whole thing would have been scrapped and would have been done over with. But House leadership asked this guy to step up and say, hey, man, why don't you put that no vote down so then we can reconsider this. So it's basically a slip and slide their operation. So as you know, the House is dealing with this slim majority. Republicans are trying to get something passed in election year so they have something they can tell their voters about. Well, this comes after Texas Congressman Al Green made a surprise appearance for the vote, literally wheeling into the House chambers in a wheelchair following a hospital stay, squashing the Republicans' plans to impeach Mayorkas this week. Mayorkas is being accused of, quote, willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and, quote, breach of public trust, close quote, over his handling of the border crisis. So Mayorkas is essentially being accused of two things. Two, as a cabinet secretary, not securing the border. That's what's being alleged there. And then the second one is lying under oath. Essentially that he lied when he testified before Congress under oath saying that the border was secure. And the Republicans say, well, in fact, it actually wasn't. So the guy lied about it. That's what's being alleged here. And this case has been questionable whether they can make it given because the Democrats, a lot of them are saying, and other people are saying, critics of this, that, you know, he doesn't really have much power as a cabinet secretary to do anything. That essentially he is a guy who is just following the orders of the president and serves at the pleasure of President Biden and can't really do much to deviate from the administration. Some people are saying, well, you know, actually the guy probably can do. So it's this debate that's being had here. And of course, the Republicans, you want to bring this border issue to attention as much as possible, especially after the Senate bill went down in flames this week, where you had this border deal. Some people were getting on board with it, but then former President Trump and some people in his neck of the woods were like, not really a great bill. You know, the president already has the ability to shut down the border, so we don't really need to make a bill about it. So in that regard, that whole thing got squashed. James Lankford, the lone Republican on that one, the guy who was at the negotiation table when this whole thing was being put together, he thought this would be a good plan. And he worked on this with independent Kyrsten Sinema. They thought they could arrange the whole thing along with Democrat Chris Murphy. The three of them got together. They thought, oh, well, this little thing will work. Well, we'll reform the asylum system and all this and that, but the Republicans did not bite on it. And now the Senate is moving towards supplying aid, because this is also going to be combined with foreign aid as well. Well, now they're working towards doing a whole separate package for Ukraine and Israel funding and all that type of funding. So there is now that whole aspect of it as well to play into this. So Republicans are trying to bring this message together. You know, the board is bad and the Democrats are the reason why, and this whole bill is just an election year thing. Now, for the Democrats, you wanted that bill to pass because you wanted to take that little piece of criticism off the Trump campaign's core messaging, saying, hey, listen, we actually are doing something about the border. We got a bill passed, and we're looking to secure the border. So you're seeing this debate now where now, you know, the Mayorkas impeachment, the House Republicans don't get to say they're, quote-unquote, holding the administration accountable. So that's a win for the Democrats, so they get to keep their guy in place. Not that he really was going anywhere, because in the Senate, it most likely either wouldn't be brought up to a trial, because, as you know, impeachment is only that's only one step of the process. You have to convict in the Senate in order to remove someone from a government position. So they would have had to convict, and you need two-thirds of the Senate chambers in order to make that happen, and they're not even going to get a majority of it if all the Democrats and the people who caucus with the Democrats, which would include the three independents who are currently sitting in the Senate, if they all get together and vote this down and acquit them, then the whole thing is for nothing, and essentially it's over. But the Republicans would still be having a messaging thing where they can go around saying they held them accountable. So they have, it just shows the tightrope that they have to walk here, because they also have to be careful not to look like they're just doing it to do it. Because you also have that Biden impeachment inquiry that's hanging in the background too. And this could be a preview of that, because, you know, you're hearing behind the scenes that they really don't have the votes for that inquiry yet. They have it to start the inquiry, but they don't really have it to actually impeach him. So they can't really move forward with that. Mayorkas was the one. They had some defectors there, clearly, but they thought they were able to get over the hump. They didn't. So now they got to try and do this again and see if they can do this on the second try. But also, it shows you the narrowness of this, that every seat matters in the Republican majority. And we're about to see this on full display this coming Tuesday night. That is where the special election is going to take place out in Long Island for George Santos' old seat. So obviously he got expelled from Congress, so they had to have a special election out in Long Island. And, well, it's also part of Queens too, but mainly the district is on Long Island. So it's that whole thing. So there's some people that you might have heard of if you're in the New York area or been paying attention for a while. There's former Democratic Congressman Tom Suozzi. He's running. He's running for the old job. He stepped out of this position. He actually decided not to run for re-election back in 2022 because he wanted to run for governor. He didn't win that primary. So basically someone else ran in his place. And of course, against George Santos, Santos beat his possible successor. So now that Santo's out, Swazi wants his old job back. He's going up against Mozzie Pillup, who is a Nassau County legislator. So she's one of the big counties out there. And she also was a former Israeli citizen. She was a member of the IDF. So she fought in the Israeli military. She was Ethiopian born. She's an Orthodox Jewish woman. So they have, the Republicans are hoping this kind of interesting candidate will be enough to do the job there. And the polling's really tight right now. Newsday came out with a recent poll showing, like, it's basically in the margin of error, although Swazi in that case had about a 4-point lead. I believe it was 47 to 43, if I got the numbers right. So it's really tight. And again, margin of error was like 4.2-ish, somewhere in there. And that really reflects what we saw in the Pix 11 poll that came out a few days earlier, before that one, where it was like within 3 points. So very tight race that's going out on Long Island. And we're going to see, because Long Island Republicans have been doing fairly well the last 3 to 4 election cycles. We're going to have to see if that momentum carries into this one and what it can tell us about the 2024 election as a whole. Because after all, it is going to be a telling sign, because that's going to be a seat Republicans are going to need to hold on to if they want to hold on to the majority. It runs through New York. You hear former President Trump talking about winning New York. He even said that they're making a major play for it over last weekend. He did an interview about that. The reason being, they got some congressional seats. He's got to run there. He's got to have strong performance if he's going to keep these guys and ladies all in the House of Representatives. They need to have a strong ground game there in order to maintain on that. If they don't, they're going to keep having votes like what they're having with Mayorkas now. It's going to keep happening. So we're going to have to see how that plays into it. And also, whether Pillup, if she is elected to the seat, would vote to impeach Mayorkas. Are they going to have that vote before she gets in? That's really a question, too. They're going to have to gamble that in House leadership. But it sounds like they're going to go with it, with or without her, because they got Steve Scalise back, and he's a solid vote in the Let's Impeach Mayorkas column, so they'll probably run with him. But it just shows you every seat matters in this majority, especially with the redistricting now, too, that they're now going to be down, especially in Alabama. They're going to be down with less because now they have to have a second black majority district down in Alabama. And as you know, African Americans tend to vote towards Democrats, although that's changing a little bit, especially among black men who seem to go more towards Trump in this election. But if the trends continue, they may be down a seat there. So they got to hold on everything they can. And we'll be watching to see if they do that. But let's talk about some other news that happened this week. The special counsel, Robert Hur, in the Biden classified documents case, well, he has finished his report, he's issued it, he's sent it to the DOJ, and now it's public. And boy, it is juicy. Now, the report does find that Biden willingly retained and disclosed highly classified material, but no charges are recommended. The special counsel points to the documents basically talking about foreign policy and military policy that was discussed regarding Afghanistan, including a 2009 classified memo that was sent to then President Obama. And it was talking about sending additional troops to the country. And Biden was against it in the memo. Obama for it, obviously, because that's what ended up happening. I mean, even years later, when they were trying to get, you know, ISIS control and the Taliban. So that was basically a whole thing there. And Biden even referred to the memo in a February 2017 recording with his ghostwriter for his book, obtained by investigators. He was living in Virginia at the time. He was renting a home down there. And he moved out in 2019, which prosecutors say he could have just, you know, forgot about the whole thing. Could have moved them and not remembered that he had this memo in his possession. Here's a part that's getting some attention that got the president all fired up at a press conference shortly after this all went down. The report says, at trial, Mr. Biden would likely present himself to a jury as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with poor memory. Well, that did not sit well with the president at all. Not at all. That would not sit well with him at all, because he did a little press conference after the whole thing went down, and I'll read you the exact quotes. Well, first he put out a statement, and the statement was kind of the same thing he started the press conference with, basically saying he was pleased the special counsel, quote, reached the conclusion I believed all along they would, that there would be no charges in this case, and the matter is now closed. Well, that part he's happy about, but I said the memory part, because Biden sat down and did a whole interview with Hearst's team for 10 hours across 2 days in early October. And he likes to point out that this happened during the early days of the Israel-Hamas war. So when he was dealing all that, he's like, I wanted to make sure I took the time out, because this is important for the American people to know that I take this very seriously. Well, though, here's the memory question, because Fox News straight out asked him about it. And he said, my memory is fine. And then he also, there was another reporter who was talking about how people feel about his age. He said, the media. And Biden responded, well, you know, that's not the media. That's what you say. So Biden was on a fury there. He was really on a tear trying to defend his mental capacity as an individual, as a president, and also amid questions about his age, because this has been a hot topic, really, for the last year or so. And even among Democrats, some have been kind of worried about it. So that did not sit well with the president. And, you know, that's going to be an issue of this campaign, because, yes, there is the no charges aspect of it, but there's also the fact it makes it look like, you know, if Republicans tee it up, and, the, you know, you clear the president's feeling it, because they did the conference. Usually they do these things like in the afternoon, maybe late morning, but they did it like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, because they wanted to show the vigor of the president, that he's still got it. He's got the energy. Well, you know, as Republicans have been saying, he doesn't have the energy, that he's a doting old man. That's what he's been accused of being. And that could be a problem, because, again, the report is specifically mentioning him, calling him an elderly man with poor memory. That is not something a lot of people want to hear. I don't know about you, but a lot of people who, shall we say, more experienced in my life, if I wrote a report and called them that, wouldn't go over well. So just a word of advice there here as we go into the Valentine's Day. You know, you obviously want to love your relatives and all that. So relatives, significant others, etc. Keep that in mind for Valentine's Day. Don't say that. In consulting people's memory, not exactly a crowd pleaser. But again, Republicans can use this to their advantage to show the evidence, because a lot of it has been a talking point. But now they can go point to all these instances where, you know, oh, I don't remember, I don't recall, because if you keep going through the report, it talks about they can't really charge him because he can't really remember anything. He can't really re- He doesn't remember the exact moments in the recording because the prosecutors are alleging that the 2017 recording about the 2009 memo, that Biden's referencing it there, but then they ask him about it and he can't put it together. He was also insistent because he has his notebook where they supposedly found all these classified documents that, and also they had some of them with markings, other documents that included top secret / secretive compartmental informal level. So, you know, the top secret is really the top, that is the top level classification in the United States government. So, you know, that's why it's somewhat, you know, it's informal communication. It's not like an intelligence briefing, but it's top secret info because, again, you're talking about Afghanistan movements and stuff like that, troop movements. That's stuff that you don't want the average person to hear about in real time because the enemy might get a hold of it by accident. So that is something that's being alleged here for Biden, that you have all these instances where you're talking about the memo and his placement. And he, what I was talking about earlier, is that he had this notebook where he had these documents just slapped in the middle of the pages. And the special counsel's office noted that his staff tried to get a hold of it, but half the time they couldn't even keep track of where the documents were and where they weren't and whether he had them or whether he not. And Biden insisted during the interview, well, I didn't have any classified documents. That's my notebook. I'm entitled to that. All the other former presidents have them, which, you know, they do sometimes have notes and memos and stuff to keep in track when they're all writing their memoirs. But a lot of it, when it comes to the classified stuff, when the presidency is over, you hand it back to the National Archives. It's a similar battle that happened with former President Trump as well, and obviously former Vice President Mike Pence, who he was completely exonerated from the whole thing. You didn't really hear about him. Now, on the Republican side, you got to be careful about this too, because you don't, like I said, you don't want, as I mentioned with my Valentine's Day reference, you don't want to insult elderly people, because if you, a lot of your voters are elderly, they don't want to hear about how they're old and have memory issues and all this and that. So you got to be careful with how you frame that too. You have to frame it as not in a joking manner, but as more of a, wow, this is a serious problem, a serious national security concern. We can't have a guy like this in the White House. That's how Republicans have to frame it. But also, they got a new way they're framing it. Well, not the new way. The new example for the same argument. And former president said it. The former president said as much on Truth Social as he was on the plane heading to Nevada for the presidential GOP caucus that they're having there. He said this is a two-tier justice system. And going back to the argument how he got the charges against him for his handling of the classified documents while Biden, in his mind, gets a scot-free pass. Although, like I said, there are instances now, these political problems that Biden is now going to have to deal with. But he's got that talking point. But, of course, the critics will point out Biden complied, and that's what was said in the report, that he did comply, willingly comply, with the request for the documents back. And he gave them access to his house and the Penn Biden Center, where he had the office where they were all first discovered, and all this and that. This has been going on for a year, almost a year. This was like early January 2023 where we first started talking about the story. And obviously there was skepticism around the search and how much transparency Biden was having, but the report kind of, you know, gives him a check mark on that front. While with Trump, the prosecutors in that case, you know, say he was withholding the documents, was refusing to give them up, and then that led to the raid of Mar-a-Lago. We all know how that went, and that was a whole deal. So that was the whole rigmarole there. And now you're seeing these cases kind of play out where Biden, it's more of a political thing. With Trump, it's a political thing, but now it's a legal thing. And now he's got to go defend himself in court. So a tale of two different stories there. And we're going to have to see how this plays out in the presidential race. Now, the presidential race isn't the only thing that's affecting that. There's also some more history that could be made. Believe it or not, we have more history that could be made this week that could affect how elections are going to happen going forward and who can actually run in them. Well, the Supreme Court is considering whether former President Trump can be banned from a state's primary ballot for his actions on January 6th using Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Well, here's what's going down here. In oral arguments this week, the justices, well, they weren't really convinced, a lot of them, or most of them, because this may not go too well here. So they expressed some skepticism here, questioning the validity of the argument. There seems to be some kind of consensus building happening here. They questioned specifically whether Congress must act before states can invoke a constitutional amendment adopted after the Civil War to prevent former office holders from going back to their old jobs after they, quote unquote, committed an insurrection for, you know, seceding from the Union. So that was what the amendment was originally intended for, and they're trying to apply it to this case. But even the liberal justices on the court, who, it's kind of been, the Supreme Court of recent years has been accused of partisan stuff and going down political lines, and the jurisprudence does, and it seems to line up with that, but it seems like everybody was on the same page for the most part. A more progressive justice, Elena Kagan, said that she basically questioned and asked, why is a single state the ones that should decide who gets to be president of the United States? And that sentiment was shared by her colleague, Brett Kavanaugh, who said the better legal argument would have been to talk about a federal statute against insurrection, which he said, if convicted, could be or shall be disqualified from office if someone were, accused of that. Well, Trump's attorney, John Mitchell, agreed with that statement, but he pushed back a little bit, saying that the president has immunity, which, again, is another case that this week the appeals court said that he does not have immunity, and they're going to appeal again. So stay tuned for that. They're going to try and go to the Supreme Court on that, so we'll have to see how that argument turns out in court. But anyways, this is what the attorney said. He said, quote, We do not concede that he can be prosecuted for that and for what he did on January 6th. Basically, this guy, during this whole hearing, was saying that Trump did not commit an insurrection. He did not take part in the events. That was the defense there. And also, it's important to note here, Trump has not been charged with insurrection. That was something Jack Smith did not charge Trump with. So at the moment, they can't really make that argument. So that's why it's kind of in play. It was more of a hypothetical, but it was more of trying to gear the conversation towards a certain way, because Ketanji Brown Jackson did kind of try and tee it out of him. Like, was this an insurrection? And obviously, the attorney didn't really give it to her. He did not really play ball with that the way she was trying to see. But again, a lot of times these justices can ask tough questions, and it may not mean anything. It may not necessarily lean into where they're going. Although, in the Dobbs hearings, you may remember that, you heard Justice Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch and all these conservative guys talk about how they were questioning the validity of Roe v. Wade and what happened a month later. Dobbs is now the law of the land, and now abortion is a state-by-state thing. So, something to watch here. We could be seeing a preview of what could be potentially happening down the pike. Now, the court is expected to rule on this quite soon. This is a special one. They came out of winter recess for this, because Super Tuesday is upon us, And that features the Colorado primary, which kicked this whole challenge off because they were the first ones where basically the state Supreme Court used a lower court ruling where even though Trump wasn't charged with insurrection, they basically ruled and the state Supreme Court affirmed it that Trump committed an insurrection on January 6th. And as of right now, he's not charged with that. And we're going to have to see where the Supreme Court lies in that. Some people are saying they're just going to stick to this argument that Congress has to act first. And because of that, that the state really can't ban him or any other state can't ban him. So we'll have to see what the extent of that ruling is and where it goes, because this could determine how the delegate count goes. And maybe for Nikki Haley, that may be something you're looking for here, because as you know, Haley has been trying to get some votes. She's gotten some delegates, but she has not won a single contest as of yet. She didn't even win that Nevada primary that doesn't count, where there was the none of the above option. She got blown out by none of the above because Trump is only on the caucus ballot. He was not on the primary ballot. So he, obviously, the caucus where the delegates are being counted, and Haley was on the primary that didn't count, and she lost that when she was not running against anybody. So that shows you where the growth potential would be for Haley. But anyways, let's get right into the middle of what we're talking about this week, because it is right here home in New Jersey. Well, the Senate primary season is underway. Campaign season is in full gear in the state of New Jersey on both sides. The Democrats are set to face off in a major battle for the Monmouth County organizational line in the coming week. But Republicans are already started. It's already happened in two counties. In Hunterdon County and Union County, both have weighed in on who they are giving their organizational line to. And they both go to one woman, Mendham Mayor Christine Serrano Glasner. Here's how that played out. So she got 152 votes in the Union County organizational line. She got that with 152. And her nearest competitor, businessman and real estate developer Curtis Bashaw, got 62 votes. And now the only other guy who really got anything worth talking about was Greg Mealy, who is a candidate who ran as a Libertarian for governor 3 years ago and ran for Congress a year after that as a Republican. Now he's running for Senate. He came in with 16 votes there. And this is, that happened one night after Glasner crushed it in the Hunterdon County convention. She got 57% of the vote there to Bashaw's 35%. So she's got the early lead right now in this race. And a guy who's not even in the race yet, former News 12 New Jersey reporter Alex Zidan, he actually got around 8% in the Hunterdon County competition, which was about 12 votes when you round everything together here. So there's a lot of interesting things to talk about with these two. The top two. You know, Greg Mealy, he's in there too. He's a Trump guy. But with Glasner in particular, she has some ties to Trump because her husband was a former campaign operative for Trump. And she worked in the Bush administration. So she's got some Republican ties there. And she endorsed former President Trump. She's all in on the Trump train. Then you got Curtis Bashaw, who, according to the New Jersey Globe, gave money to Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson in 2016, and our own former governor, Chris Christie, in his most recent presidential bid. But as of right now, he says he's going to be supporting the Republican ticket this fall. Well, joining me now to discuss his campaign is the man himself, the real estate developer, and the businessman from South Jersey, New Jersey Republican Senate candidate Curtis Bashaw. Curtis, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, Joey. Thanks for having me. Thanks for doing this.
You're currently running for Senate. What made you decide to jump into this thing?
A couple step process here. First of all, I think voters like the fact that people aren't from inside government. I think they're hungry for outsiders, especially those with business experience, making budgets, making payrolls, participating in the economy. But two triggers for me in getting involved in this were go back to COVID, where we suddenly lost our rights to run our businesses and live our lives. The draconian lockdowns in New Jersey and the one size fits all solutions that they were foisting on us were just not right. And you kind of realized all of a sudden that the price of liberty is in fact eternal vigilance. And we formed a committee in our community for reopening in Cape May County. Our chairman and our committee members on the county board, as well as the mayors and business people, formed a group to write a reopening plan that worked for our county. We had to be open for our summer season, and New Jersey was moving at a snail's pace to even start to think about it. There were young appointees, kids really, up there making decisions on the fly, hiding behind, we're following the science. Meanwhile, it didn't make any sense. We wrote a plan, we sent it to Trenton, they sat on it, and we had to ultimately leverage that plan to get ourselves open. You know, our governor was marching in protest marches while we couldn't shop on Main Street, and it wasn't making sense. That was the first thing. This fall, you know, when I heard about the Menendez round two corruption, this time with gold bars, you realize that the voters deserved better. And then when the Murphys say in some sort of dynastic approach to governance that she should have the Senate seat, that just was it for me. And I said, you know what? I believe there's a path to take back the Senate seat in New Jersey for the first time in 50 years. And that's because issues that were our issues as Republicans have become bipartisan issues. The border is a mess. It's scaring people. And that's not just Republicans. The Democrats and independents are upset with illegal people coming into our community, spilling out from New York City into our northern counties. And it's very upsetting. And then parental rights are really being stomped on in this sort of post-woke environment where people keep wanting to tell each other what to do and take away our liberties. So I said, you know, I've been successful over my career. I've loved being a business person. And, you know, we are of the people, by the people, for the people in this country. And if people that are outside government don't step up, then we're going to get what we deserve.
You talk about your experience outside government. You said right at the top that you say people like someone who's outside of government. But it's important to note you were the executive director of the Casino Reinvestment Development Authority under the McGreevy administration. So you have some government experience, but you've never held elected public office. What experience would you bring to the Senate if elected?
I'll tell you what I've done. When we went to renovate Congress Hall back in 2000, 2001, it was a abandoned 200-year-old hotel that no one thought could have another life. And I had a vision for that thing. And what I realized in the process of doing that deal was I had to get all these disparate stakeholders to the same place at the same time. I had to get code officials, fire safety officials, and preservationists to all agree on a plan for the building. And we had to have that plan be something that enticed capital to invest, lenders, and also would be a product that consumers would want. I think that these experiences of building a business are very appropriate to our Congress. If the productivity of Congress is bad, it's a broken institution, and it needs, if it was a department in my business, I would have taken it apart and looked under the hood and figured out how to make it better. I think That experience will help in the U.S. Congress work to solve problems that have been festering for decades. Immigration is one of them. And so I look forward to that. When I was at the CRDA, I took a 2-year sabbatical from my business to run that agency. I got to know all kinds of people all over the state, worked within government to reinvest casino gaming taxes in economic development. You know, the best social program out there is a job, and we need to work with people that have created jobs to help invigorate our government processes so that they're more efficient and more productive and get better results.
As you mentioned earlier on here, that you believe you have a path for the first time in 50 years to win a Senate seat as a Republican. As you know, that hasn't been done since 1972, the year Richard Nixon was elected. There's over 900,000 more registered Democrats in New Jersey than Republicans. What is the path in your mind?
The path in my mind is to take advantage of this moment in our time. Voters are restless. They're not happy. You know, the promise of our country was to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There was supposed to be domestic tranquility. People are upset. They're worried about safety and security, not only at our border, but in their communities, in their schools. And that is not a Republican issue. If we can pull from the independents, and which is a vast number of New Jersey voters, as well as from the Democrats, many of whom are dissatisfied with this process that the Murphys are doing to try to grab the nomination, I think that we can create steamroll through this general election and bring back the Senate to a Republican seat.
In terms of turnout, there's been a debate over how to engage voters in your party, particularly people who are running for office as Republicans. Some, including former President Trump, have called for the GOP to embrace mail-in voting as well as early voting. The RNC in particular has spent millions of dollars investing in vote by mail. Will you use these turnout methods as part of your campaign to engage voters?
Absolutely. I think the Democrats beat us at that game in the past, and Republicans need to use all the tools in the arsenal to get voter turnout. We have to run an organization that's on the ground, county by county, city by city, with Get Out the Vote, and to drive people to the polls again. People need to believe in the process again. There needs to be election integrity, and we need to engage with the citizens. Republicans have sat back too long, and they haven't gone into the trenches to win vote by vote.
Now, before you get to the general election, you got to go through the primary. You're running against a number of opponents in that Republican primary, but your chief rival seems to be right now Mendham Mayor Christine Serrano Glassner, who has already racked up a ton of endorsements. She's been seen as the front runner in this race up until this point. How do you plan on competing with her?
I think the strength of the competition is to have someone that can win a general election. And Christine came out early in September. I've just joined this race. But I think that between our fundraising ability, you've got to raise money to win an election. And I believe that we will be able to attract the investment of voters, myself, and people that will back a campaign like this because they want a candidate that can win the general election in New Jersey.
You talk like a guy who some Republican voters might have heard of before. You say you're a businessman, you're an outsider. That sounds like former President Trump when he ran back in 2016. In an interview with NJ Spotlight News, you were asked about whether you would support former President Trump as a Republican nominee. You said you plan on supporting the Republican ticket, but it's important to note you have not supported the former president in the past. Do you plan on casting your vote for him this time around if he ultimately wins the GOP nomination?
I voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and in 2020. I actually worked with President Trump when I was at the CRDA. I met with him and needed to convince him. At the time, he owned three casinos in Atlantic City on a project we were working on. I am going to support our ticket top to bottom this November, and I'm very focused on being part of that ticket so that we can take New Jersey for the Republicans.
Now, in an interview with Fox News host Maria Bartiromo last weekend, the former president said he thinks New Jersey can be flipped red. He's already talking about the possibility of campaigning in New York City. He's done one rally in the past back in 2020 down Wildwood. If the former president makes a visit to the state and offers you a spot on that stage when he's doing a rally, would you welcome him to campaign for you? Would you go on that stage with him?
I'm working with the Republican Party in our state. I am excited that the president believes that we can flip New Jersey, and I agree with him 100%. I think New Jersey almost elected Jack Cittarelli a few years ago, came very, very close, and we need to unite as a party, and we need to bring in independents and Democrats to the party so that we solve the issues for the people in New Jersey. We're going to do whatever we can in this campaign to help effectuate that outcome.
So you're a guy who says you support President Trump. That's something that primary voters obviously like to see, as right now he seems to be dominating the Republican primary circuit. But it's also important to note you did work for a Democratic Governor Jim McGreevy. Now, you know how some Republicans can be like. They might see that and be like, oh no, can we trust this guy? What would your response be to those skeptical Republican voters who may be like, I don't know, do I want a guy who worked with a Democrat? How would you respond to that?
I think we have to govern for all of America and for all of its citizens and for all New Jerseyans. And I believe that we have to absolutely reach across the aisle and work on practical and common sense solutions for all of New Jerseyans. I am not ashamed that I have worked with Democrats in the past. I've worked with fellow citizens at the CRDA under a Democratic administration to do good projects and to invest those gaming taxes in good investments. And I believe that our voters in New Jersey will appreciate that. I think the name calling and the posturing and dividing people into subsets and factions is not the way for the Republican Party to have statewide impact.
Now, some people may not know this about you. You are a gay man and you're married to your husband, Will. If elected, you would be the first openly gay candidate to win statewide from either party. Although there was former Democratic Governor Jim McGreevy, who was your former boss. He came out as gay while serving, but then he had to resign shortly after that, but that was unrelated to his sexuality in particular. Though New Jersey has made progress on embracing the LGBTQ community, including codifying gay marriage, there are still some who remain uncomfortable with homosexuality. Catholics are a large voting bloc in the state, particularly in your party, and a lot of them believe same-sex marriage is not acceptable. This is particularly true among older voters who typically come out and vote in primary elections. How do you plan to convince voters who may be hesitant to vote for someone like you?
I think that Americans and New Jerseyans appreciate people for who they are, and our country was founded on really amazing freedoms. We have freedom of conscience, we have freedom of speech, freedom of worship, religion, enterprise. These freedoms come with a cost. The cost is that we have to live next door to someone that we might not agree with. The domestic tranquility that our Constitution refers to gives all of us a safe space to go to in our homes to be who we are. And I think people respect that. I think the issues that are important are the policy issues and choices we make. You know, I believe in our free enterprise system. I think there's the border is an issue. We could go down that list, but I'm Curtis Bashaw first and foremost, and I'm running for United States Senate. I happen to be gay. I happen to be a business person, and I've lived my life and appreciate the freedoms that we now have to marry those that we love in our state.
Now, you mentioned the border. We've called it a mess at one point in this interview. There's currently a bipartisan deal in the Senate going around on the border. It includes reforming the asylum system, giving the president the power to shut down the border, and ending catch and release, among other things. If you were in the Senate right now, would you vote for this bill?
I believe that all efforts to make our border safer are important. I think the big, to have it be, it's been politicized for far too long. President Biden has the power now to close the border. And to do this dance that we're doing is not as productive as the president acting and enforcing the laws on the books. By fiat of a pen, he eliminated President Trump's policies and he could put them back. I think he could be doing a lot more right now on the border, and that they've turned this into a political football in a campaign, and that's not the best approach for him as a leader. Biden needs to address this.
You say the president needs to address this now. He has the power. That's the debate surrounding this bill, is you have people like former President Trump who are like, oh, wow, this is, you know, the president already has this power. Why are we doing anything about it? But then you got people who are in the Senate saying, well, we need to give him the power along with the rest of the administration in order to close this border. We got to do something on this bill. You said you support all efforts to deal with the border. Does that include this bill? Would you vote for this bill?
I don't know the inner workings of this bill. I think that the country is hungry for a solution. It's a national security threat and it's a humanitarian crisis. And I would support every effort to work on that. I am dismayed that our president hasn't, in the 3 years that he's been in office, addressed this already.
Now, the bill also includes funding for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Some Republicans in Washington have pushed for these funding proposals to be considered separately from border security. Should they all be combined into one bill, or should there be separate legislation for each issue?
Washington has always worked by creating compromises, and I think that's part of our democratic process. I think that, you know, a strong America is important, and we need to help our friends, and we need to do that urgently. But we also have to make sure that we're strong at home. And I think the debate that's happening is combining those issues because they are connected. They don't want to invest in foreign wars when people are pouring across the border. So I understand why both these issues are on the table. And I sincerely hope that we're able to make sure that we're a strong America so that we can help the other countries.
Right. You say you want to have, obviously, a strong America, but at the same time, you know, these foreign wars, they're starting to accumulate in cost. And also, you said you want to deal with the border. But would you want these, if there was, like, let's put aside this thing, since obviously, you know, there's some controversy around what the border, but let's say, hypothetically, if it had all the border stuff you liked, along with Ukraine funding and Israel funding, is that something you get behind of, something that had all three of these issues that are on the minds of Americans?
I believe that America has to be true to its friends, that America has a role in the world. You know, when I get on an airplane and they do the safety procedures, I'm always struck by the notion that when the oxygen mask comes down, I need to put it on my own face before I put it and help the person next to me. And that's the analogy I use when it comes to this conversation about our involvement overseas. I believe that we need to help our friends and allies, and I believe we need to be strong at home. We can't help others if we're not strong here, and that's why this porous border is such a resounding issue for so many Americans.
Finally, I know we got to get going here, but just real quickly, the House is currently conducting an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. Some Republicans are all in on impeachment, while some say they support the inquiry, but are not ready to go that far to call for an impeachment. Do you support the prospect of impeaching the president?
I think the best way to get past President Biden is to vote him out of office in November. I think that you know, when I was a boy and learned about our American history, there was one impeachment that happened with Andrew Jackson, Johnson. And that all of a sudden, you know, these impeachments, the Clinton impeachment backfired on Republicans. Newt Gingrich talked about that. I think the Trump impeachments backfired on Democrats. I'm not sure that it should be used as a political tool. And I think that we're coming up on an election where the voters can choose a mandate on President Biden.
Now, I know you say it should be left up to the voters, but let's put that aside there. In the general inquiry, just the looking into it, do you support the aspect of there being an inquiry regarding impeachment?
I support the constitutional process. And if there are crimes that rise to a level that demand that scrutiny, it's important to do. I sometimes have felt of late that this has become a political football where we're starting to impeach everybody all the time. And it's expensive and it's cost, it's a distraction in many instances. You know, in this circumstance, I think if there's legitimate inquiries, that's a reasonable thing to do. And that's Congress's role. But I think that the shortest, easiest path in this instance is to win at the ballot box in November.
Yeah, we'll have to see where this goes for Biden and Trump as well as yourself. We'll be watching your campaign. New Jersey Republican Senate candidate Curtis Bashaw, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joey.
Well, that about does it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. You can also do it on X, formerly known as Twitter, at @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. And in case you just found the show for the first time, you're like, oh my God, this is so great. I love the show, but where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You got to go to your browser. You got to type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com. You put that in and you're going to go to the listen and watch and you're going to go to the podcast section, or you can type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast, whatever is easier for you. But anyways, once you get to that podcast page for all the Fox Sports New Jersey podcasts, you're going to scroll down till you find in the middle Joey Block. You're going to click on that and all the episodes will be there. We have the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.